Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Bye, bye, baby. I am brown baby.
Hello, welcome to the Brown Baby Podcast. I'm your host, Nikesh Shukla. How do we raise our kids with joy and wonder in uncertain and, let's face it, bleak times? This is a question explored every week in my podcast, Brown Baby. And the whole thing was inspired by my memoir, Brown Baby, a memoir of race, family and home, which is out now. And so, because I love having conversations around parenting and talking about my deepest, darkest fears, I invite parents of brown babies on to talk to me. So we have writers, musicians, chefs, comedians, actors and more to talk about their parenting journeys and the highs and lows they've experienced along the way. Speaking of my memoir, you know you can buy it, right? There's a link tree right in the show notes that'll take you to the sites that aren't the one that everyone tends to use. I mean, me personally, I would prefer if you bought it from an independent bookshop or from a book chain, but it's not up to me to make decisions on where you shop. So please just buy it wherever you want. But if you're one of those lovely people who wants to buy the book and wants to avoid the site that shall not be named, head to my link tree in the show notes for some top, top places. Now, to this week's podcast, we have the amazing writer Derek A. Bardawell. He is the author of the book No Win Race. No Win Race is Derek's deeply personal exploration into the complexities and biases implicit in being black in Britain, told through the prism of sport. It covers the period between the Brixton riots and Brexit, and it is a visceral, powerful book for those who want an honest insight into race relations in the UK and for anyone who understands that sport is more than just a game. No Win Race was a Sunday Times Sports Book of the Year, a Financial Times Sports Book of the Year, and it was longlisted for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year as well. Derek is a great writer and an absolute delight to talk to. We've spoken on the internet before, but never really in person. This was the first time we chatted, and it was a warm and lovely and very sweet chat. We spoke about the power of sport, trying to get our kids to be into the same stuff as us, and also the things our immigrant parents went through. It's a gorgeous chat. But first, how do you stop your kids saying poo? Like it's the funniest thing in the world. I'm happy for them to laugh and make jokes, but I just wish it was better banter, you know? That is the thing that's been haunting me all of this week. Poo, 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 poo. It's been all the chat all the entire time, and they just fall about giggling like it's a Stuart Lee joke, and it's one of those things that's funny, then funny, then funny, then not funny, then not funny, then funny, and poo, 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 poo. And I just, today, lost my temper. Because every time I've tried to ban the word in the last few weeks, it just gives it more power. It makes them want to say it more. And so every time I try to pivot to something else, they keep bringing it back to poo. And today I just lost my mind while we were playing Lego. And I decided to overexpose them to the word, like full-scale radiation poisoning or something. So I just started saying poo, 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 over and over again. Poo, 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 poo. And they laughed, and they laughed, and they laughed, and it wasn't working. And but I had to keep going. I'd committed to it. Poo, 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 poo. And then they laughed. Poo, poo, poo. And then it wasn't funny. Poo, 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 poo. And then it was irritating. Poo, poo, poo. And I thought, it's working. I have to keep overexposing them to it. Poo, poo, poo. Radiate them. Poo, poo, poo. And then I said it one time too many. And then it was funny again. Like a goddamn Stuart Lee joke. And I laughed as well. Now to the podcast interview, Derek A. Bardwell. Welcome to the podcast, Derek. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing, Nikesh?
Yeah, I am. Yes, I am fine. I had one of those mornings where the school run just seemed so impossible and everything was running like 5 minutes behind and everyone was being belligerent about the things that they needed to do. And my youngest would only let her eldest sister put on her shoes and wouldn't let me do it. And she then wanted to do her poppers up on her coat herself, but she obviously was struggling with doing the poppers and we were running up the road. And oh my God, it was just one of those mornings. How has your morning been?
Same, you know, always concerned about, you know, my kids and period of COVID and whether they're going to end back at home again. Yeah. And all of that sort of stuff. So all kind of insecure, but yeah, not as crazy as what your morning was.
Both your kids in school?
Yeah, so I've got a 15-year-old and a 10-year-old. So the 15-year-old is in her final year and is doing her GCSEs, so that's crazy. And yeah, I got a 10-year-old in primary school, so yeah, I mean all good. And they're managing or have managed, you know, the last few months impeccably well, you know.
How has your 15-year-old been coping with you know, having to do exams in a 3 months time? And
Far better than her parents. she's quite laid back, and you always get concerned with your kids, right? It's because you're always quite, you know, concerned that, you know, maybe what's going on internally is completely different to the way that they're managing it externally. But you know, she's you know, she does her thing, and you know, and I think that's the thing that's really come out so much, you know, over the last few months, is that, you know, school always makes me slightly nervous and anxious because I'm always worried about what they're learning. I'm always worried about, you know, whether the individual nature of your kids that you see the best of them is allowed to flourish in the school environment. And so I always spend my time feeling really anxious, and then just seeing her at home and watching her super duper creative self, her, you know, invention, her wackiness, her weirdness, you know, I've sort of thought, you know, she's cool, she's okay, whatever. I don't know what she's gonna do and I don't know where she's gonna go, but you know, she and I don't know whether the school gets her and whether schooling in this country allows that space for people to, you know, for kids to just be themselves and flourish in that way. But you know, I just thought to myself over the last few months, you know, she just got a multitude of just different things and stuff that she can do, whether the school can spot it or not doesn't, you know, is not a huge concern, to be honest.
Is she at the stage where you're hugely embarrassing, or is she at the stage where you guys can kind of carry on conversations and be excited about things and kind of share each other's interests?
Well, it's funny, we're still talking. So everyone said to me, right, they said, you know, when your daughter gets to secondary school, she's going to stop talking to you. And I said, for how long? They said, well, probably until she's about 20. And I was like, 20, that's like a whole decade she's gonna stop talking to me. It's like, yeah, because you know, you're gonna be kind of uncool, you know, you're probably gonna be a bit embarrassing, and you know, before that point you would have probably been really cool to her, or you would have thought that you're really cool to her and her friends or whatever, and yeah, you'll just become an embarrassment, and then she will, you know, just not talk to you for a time. And I've been quite fortunate that, you know, she's got to, you know, her final year of GCSEs, and she's still talking to me, probably is embarrassed by me and all of that, but at the same time, you know, we're still talking, so it hasn't been a whole decade lost. Now I'm still preparing for the second part of that phase to happen, you know, so it could still happen, but yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, you don't want to get to the bit where the only time she talks to you is when she needs money, because I feel like, yeah, well, I feel like from the age of like 16, well no, I'd never asked my parents for money until I was in my early 20s and wanted to move out, I think. But yeah, like there was a period where The only conversations I ever had with my parents was to get them to bail me out.
Well, it's, you know what, I had this weird one because I've got two older sisters. And the thing is, when I first started getting pocket money, which was a big thing because I got my pocket money years later than any of my friends got pocket money. And when I got that money, it was nowhere near the amount of money that my friends had. My friends had notes.
What?
Right? They had notes. Yeah, they had notes. They had notes for pocket money.
Jeez.
And I was like, I had coins. And so when I had my coins, the first thing that I would do was go up and buy, I don't know, whatever the Marathon, which is now Snickers. I'd buy, you know, some sweets. And that's pretty much all I would buy. And then my older sister, she just grasped on me. She just told my dad, she said, oh, Dad, you know what? Every time you give Derek the little bit of change that I had for the week, he just buys sweets. So then I just got banned. Like, my dad just cut my pocket money and that was it. So that whole notion of trying to buy anything or asking my mum and dad for money and stuff like that. Food, clothing, shelter, everything, that's cool, but money, yeah, that wasn't really happening. But yeah, I blame my sister for that one.
Yeah, I think from the age of 15, I had part-time jobs. I worked every weekend, and because I've got two older cousins who are twins, and they would always be dressed in exactly the same clothes, I always got their hand-me-down, so I would always get two sets of the same clothes, so like I'd fit into one and then grow out of it and then immediately grow into the next one, and so I never had my own stuff. And so as soon as I turned 16, you know, I would work, you know, more out, I'd pull in more hours than my mum and dad would know about, just so I'd have that extra money so I could go and buy my own things. But then I look back at it now and I'm like, damn, I had two sets of this amazing LA Lakers bomber jacket when I was like 14 years old. That was like the original golden era Magic Johnson.
Nice.
Lakers jacket. And I don't know where that ended up. That probably ended up in like a charity shop or something. What an idiot.
No, but okay, if you want to talk about being an idiot, I can't remember the age I was, but for some reason I purchased a life-size cardboard cutout of Magic Johnson, a 6'9" monstrosity of a cardboard cutout of Magic Johnson that sat in my bedroom. Well, it didn't sit in my bedroom.
It
towered over everything for years and years because I was a huge Lakers fan, right? Yeah. So, you know, I remember like mid-80s and they just started showing some, you know, the NBA. And the Lakers were like all flash. Jack Nicholson was on the sidelines and all of that. And so I was like, Magic Johnson, that's my man right there. So I found a way of purchasing this, you know, no disrespect to Magic, but, you know, in a very tiny bedroom in your mum and dad's house where you walk in and Magic's kind of looking down at you every time you walk in. You know, it didn't quite go with the house, you know what I mean?
Yeah, God. They had a brilliant season last year. I was in LA like a year and a half ago, and it was just after LeBron had moved to the Lakers when that team still hadn't quite figured themselves out yet, and they were really bad. And they lost to the Dallas Mavericks. Is it the Dallas Mavericks?
Could have been.
God, yeah. Oh, God. It was a terrible match, and we were, you know, the cheapest seats possible, like right at the top. And I think you don't realize up until you're sitting in those seats how high they go up.
Yeah.
Where you know, you're watching the entire thing actually like on the screen rather than on the court. Because
so every time I've gone to the States, I always take in a game, right? Every time without fail. And it's like, you know, and all you can really afford, you're right, the nosebleed seats, that's about it. But you literally have to watch the screen in the middle because you are so far away from the action. The people that surround you are kind of a little uninterested in what's going on. You're sort of away from the atmosphere of everything. But, you know, it's always a pleasure if you get to see some of those players playing.
Yeah, it was really cool seeing LeBron play. And it's just one of those things where, like, you don't realize until you're actually there that they have an announcer announce who is playing, like who has the ball, and each player has their own like 10-second sting, and it's really helpful when you're so far away. that you're able to figure the game out and figure out what's going on. Obviously, you write so wonderfully about sport. Like, do you try and bring your kids in with you into following sports and stuff, or are they like, that's dad stuff?
Nah, the poor things, they get dragged to basketball games with me over here, you know. So they're more doers than they are watchers, you know. So my son, he plays football, and he plays football I think 4 times a week, and you know, he loves it. It's his passion. It's so much fun to him. I find it torturous watching him in matches, because I just kind of live and breathe every single minute that he plays.
Are you the dad on the sideline shouting?
I try not to be, but I end up being that dad on the sideline, and I always end up being a bit like that sort of overly critical dad as well, you know, the dad that sort of says, okay, get back into position, and I see my son sort of looking at me at times like, okay, you've just contradicted yourself with what you've said with your instructions, and that doesn't align with what my coach is actually saying.
Yeah.
So it's always quite torturous, but you know, he enjoys it, and he has a laugh at my expense in terms of my sideline instructions and bad instructions. And my daughter, she's the same. She likes, you know, climbing and anything that's slightly dangerous in terms of sport, but prefers to do it than watch it. But you know, at the same time, I'm such a huge basketball fan, and I watch I'd take them to, you know, the games over here, because there's the British Basketball League over here, and you know, obviously it's not like the NBA and it's not as good as the NBA, but the thing that you get to do is you get right close to the court, and you're able to see what's going on. You're able to get right in with the action. And so my kids, they absolutely love it. And then, you know, the players over here tend to be quite cool guys, so they'll be high-fiving my kids as they're going by, you know. We'll take pictures of them afterwards, but the main thing is that they're so close to the action, unlike going to some other sports. You know, I'm sure going to see Arsenal or West Ham, or I've gone to see, you know, Crystal Palace before, which has been fantastic, but you're so far away from the action that you don't get to sort of breathe it and experience it in quite the same way.
In the early noughties, I worked for a football club on this really interesting project. It was Charlton Athletic for years, the valley where their ground had been in disrepair, so they shared their stadium with Millwall. When they moved back to the valley, I can't remember when they moved back to the valley. I started this job in like 2002, maybe. Like, the socioeconomic makeup of Charlton had completely changed, and there was like now a huge Bangladeshi community. There was a huge Vietnamese community. You know, there was huge swathes of immigrant families had moved into the area, and on match days they would all be fucking terrified when, you know, Charlton, you know, used to. Well, I don't know. I've been out of that scene for a minute, but you know, traditionally their fans, you know, it's like horrible football firms would like be like walking through Charlton singing racist offensive songs, and all these people who had moved to the area, they'd be terrified to leave their house. And so Charlton Athletic, to their credit, worked with Greenwich Council to start up an anti-racism project, and it was like in the heady days of Labour's community cohesion and social integration projects. And I worked on one of them, worked on a project just to bring families together, to basically make them feel comfortable enough to sit in the stands and watch football matches.
So Charlton, and I completely understand that change that happened at that point, but Charlton was really ahead of the game at that time, because they had Michelle Moore was running a lot of the stuff at Charlton at the time, and I think Rebel Ahmed and I think Anne Herriman, I might be forgetting, but you had these amazing practitioners who were really good at being able to change the culture of Charlton from what it was before to the days that you were there. And you know, and I just always felt that type of work sometimes, and I write a bit about it in the book, in No Win Race, that whole thing where there's these amazing things that happen in various communities that either, for whatever reason, either get erased or they lose funding, but actually they've shown a way in which football should act. and they were doing it like 20 years ago. You know, we've seen that nothing hugely has changed in football in terms of racism on the terraces and stuff, and racism in terms of, you know, who gets to make the decisions in football. But then you look at some of the stuff that has been done previously and you're like, well why didn't that get more funding, or why wasn't that, you know, mainstreamed or adopted more widely? Because it would answer some of the problems that we have right now.
So yeah, let's talk about No Win Race for a bit. It's out in paperback now.
Yeah.
So can you just tell the listeners a bit about the book? There's a bit of the book that I'm leading before you've even told us what the book is.
Well, you know, it really looks at the race and racism in Britain through the lens of sport, you know, and it looks at, you know, the last 40 years of that. So pretty much, you know, my life from being a primary school student to now. And I guess, you know, sport said so much about what was going on in society for me through different, you know, times. For me, I always remember elements of my life through things like World Cups and the Olympics. You know, some people will talk about the soundtrack to their lives and think about music and how that's the soundtrack to their lives. For me, it was sporting events. And so the good and the bad of what was happening in my life at that particular time, I kind of remember it through, you know, Lennox Lewis versus Frank Bruno, or the 2012 Olympics, or Minta Hagler and things of that nature. So, you know, I really wanted to tell that story. I really wanted to tell the story of, and I really wanted to tell it as a story of, you know, these things that we experienced, and, you know, the conversations that I would have had with my school friends were just not reflected in any of what was coming out in the newspapers or how people were commentating about the sport at the time. So I really wanted to tell that side of the story, and also the fact that, you know, as a kid, I just wanted to watch sport for fun. You know, yeah. I just, you know, and if you're a footballer or a tennis player or whatever sport you were doing, and you were a black person doing any of those sports, you're not there to be a political figure. You just want to excel in the work that you're doing. And, you know, obviously race and racism follows you everywhere in this country. And suddenly, you know, all of the things that I was dealing with as a kid on the street, you know, was just reflected in, you know, watching Match of the Day on a Saturday night, the boos and, you know, the things that people had to deal with, the players had to deal with at the time. I was like, God, I can't enjoy this thing that's meant to be escapism for me. It's not escapism for me, because it's just reflecting my day-to-day reality. So I really wanted to tell that story, but I also wanted to just celebrate, you know, these players and some of the unsung heroes of sport.
You raise an amazing point about just wanting to watch football, and, you know, the players just wanting to play football. And, you know, I think there's, you know, we have it perfectly in the news at the moment with Marcus Rashford, where you know, Marcus Rashford is 23 years old, 24 maybe now. Do you think he wants to spend his time being a campaigner and an activist and enjoy heaps and heaps of abuse on Twitter for asking a seemingly obvious and, you know, open-hearted thing? Like, he would much rather be playing football, I don't know, playing on a PlayStation if he owns a PlayStation, watching whatever he's watching on Netflix, getting on with his life. Like, he doesn't want to be doing all the other stuff, in the same way that, like, you know, I do find that if you are a prominent person of colour, be it, you know, in the arts, in entertainment, in sports and so on and so forth, you often also bring with you like a campaigning side, and it's almost like incumbent on you to do it. It would be irresponsible of us to not use our platforms to do this.
It's so difficult. It's such a difficult balance, because, you know, in the one sense, you're like, I just want to write a book, you know, and I just want to write something that is just going to be, you know, fun. And I'm not saying that you can't talk about these topics in ways that are not joyful and abundant and beautiful and all of that sort of stuff, but it follows you. And that's the thing, is that for me, so many people that I know and admire and respect, irrespective of what field they're in, be it lawyers, be it people in the media, it's inescapable. So even if to some degree they don't want to do it, they always end up being an activist voice, because if you're in any position of privilege whatsoever, it's really tough to be in that position and not do something about it. And I think, you know, Marcus Rashford, what he's doing, Raheem Sterling, what those guys are doing is amazing, largely because, not just because of their age, but because, unlike previous generations, they're doing it at the peak of their powers. They're doing it at a time when it's most at risk for them in terms of, you know, the next few years of their career. And I think they've taken a lot of learning from, you know, a lot of the American basketball stars who have said, do you know what, I'm putting myself out there, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to write and control this narrative. You know, I'm not going to enable anyone to tell this story. So you see Marcus active on social media, you see him counteracting negative stuff that's written about him, which is crazy, because I'm just like, why are you going to write negative stuff about Marcus Rashford? You know, he's doing an amazing thing. But the fact that they're just so self-aware about really being able to control their narrative, for me, is really important. And it's just also important that, you know, my son, who loves football, you know, he will get his Marcus Rashford card. And even though he is, my son's a Man City fan, he will look at his Marcus Rashford card with a great deal of pride because of what he's doing and what he's contributing. And, you know, that's not the one route or the only route to social change. You know, famous people's, you know, is part of the equation, but it's really fundamentally important.
One of the things that you write about in No Win Race that I really love is this idea of sport, of football, as a unifier for communities. And I really love that idea. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think if... So I've been fortunate to have really been around some amazing educators. And when I say educators, I mean they may be coaches and qualified coaches, but what they're really good at doing is creating really inclusive environments for young people, which means that, you know, it doesn't matter what your ability is or what your background is, they're very good at being able to integrate people. And I think that's just been one of the lost arts of the education system is, you know, I'm definitely not saying that sport can solve problems and whatever, but what I am saying is that I have seen through organizations like Fight for Peace and Peace Players International and others, where they've really been able to get, you know, young people on the right track. They've really been able to bond, you know, young people from different backgrounds, and they've been able to speak to young people in a way or in a language that perhaps other things haven't succeeded. And so it's really important. But what I don't get is why the techniques that some of these social enterprises, what they use, and a bit like what we were saying earlier about Charlton and what, you know, Michelle and those guys were doing earlier, why that isn't more widespread in schools, you know. And again, it's not going to solve the problem, but it's part of the equation that's really, really missed in terms of the ability and the power of sport to really bond people. And of course, it's hugely symbolic. It's hugely symbolic that, you know, that ability for sport, and you'll know this yourself if, you know, you watch sport, it can disarm people in a way that very few things can, you know.
I put out a YA book about a young kid who takes up boxing after...
Boxing, yeah, yeah.
To help him deal with the trauma of a racist attack, and he kind of finds himself and he finds a community in his boxing gym. And one of the really amazing things about doing that book and talking to young people about it was discovering how much boxing was used as a way of helping young men living in difficult situations and from difficult backgrounds, helping give them focus and structure in a way that school aimed to do, but not everyone is ready for that academic way of structure changing their life at the point at which it was tends to arrive in their lives. And so these boxing gyms and these boxing programs were doing all these amazing things to basically help these young guys just focus on something And it was really inspiring to watch.
So you might know of Empire up in Bristol.
Empire's where I trained. So,
oh, is that where you trained? Yeah. Oh my God. So I think one of the very first events that I did was with Empire. When I released the book in 2019, one of the very first events was with Empire, because I was just like, this is what I'm speaking to. You know, this is, you know, what they are able to do. Where, you know, look, they're able to produce elite fighters in that gym, but they're able to bond communities in that gym. They're able to work with young people who are on the wrong side of the track in that gym. And I'm like, you know, and I, as I said, you've got organizations like Fight for Peace and others across, you know, Track Academy that does that through, you know, athletics, you know, that are doing this amazing stuff in ways that are unimaginable in terms of the sense of belonging that they give to, you know, not just young people, you know, it's like a whole community of people who, this is their community. This is the place where they feel really safe and where they can express themselves. And you know, the work that organizations like them do is amazing to me, but should be resourced far more.
I feel like you might even have invited me to that event, but I wasn't in town that day, or maybe not. I think I probably did. Yeah, it's a wonderful space. It's basically, I had such preconceptions about what boxing gyms were like until I went into that space, and everyone was just like, we get new people in here all the time. For whatever brought you here, but you're here. And it was such a lovely open space. And I would Chris, the guy who set it up, who, you know, is a fabled ex local hero boxer, I'd see him every morning, because I like to go in the morning when there was no one else there, when I was sort of learning to throw a punch, and he'd always just sort of stand there and chat with me and fix my form and all the rest of it, while he was like, had a towel draped around him. I don't think he lived there. He obviously didn't live there, but I think he often had his morning shower at the gym.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Going back to parenting, and one of the things that I really love about your work is it is so community focused and community minded, and so much about young people and, you know, helping young people to kind of find focus. And when you think about your own parents and how you were raised, can you just tell us a little bit more about how you viewed your parents when you were growing up?
Yeah, so my parents are everything. You know, and I always said that. And when the book came out, it was so much of a dedication to them as well as my kids, largely because, you know, I know that, you know, they, you know, my dad, you know, first came over from Jamaica, you know, having grown up without, you know, running water or, you know, electricity in his house, and to be able to make the life that he did over here. And do so through unbelievable levels of sort of patience and tolerance was really amazing to me. And then, and again with the book, you know, I was reflecting on the fact that, you know, so much stuff is written about black men and black manhood is negative, and always tends to be stuff on absent fathers, crime, etc. And I really was like, well, you know, this wasn't my reality, and this wasn't a reality for the majority of my peers. You know, we had, you know, involved fathers, we had, and you know, it's not like all of us knew how to manage life in Britain, or life raising a second generation black kid in Britain who was, you know, my generation was deemed as a problem to the state. You know, we were deemed as, you know, muggers, and things of that nature, you know. And there were so many of my peers, black male peers, who were you know, excluded from school or got into trouble. And you know, at the time you didn't know what was going on, and you weren't quite sure. And so my dad, you know, was playing that juggling act, which is the same juggling act that I'm playing with my son, which is, you know, here's the reality of the situation. Mm. How do I build you up to be resilient to a country that is going to discriminate against you without lessening your ambitions, without you know, crushing your dreams? Yeah. And all of that. And it's such a difficult juggling act. But the thing that was really, you know, as I was writing the book, the thing that really struck me was that my dad was, you know, he grew up in Jamaica. He, you know, as a black male whose conception of racism, because he's grown up around black people, was not the same as mine, where from a very young age I was aware of racism growing up as a black kid. And even though Newham, where I grew up, was, you know, multicultural, it was still burdened by the National Front. It was still burdened, you know, we had National Front leafleting outside of our school gates. You know, we had, you know, police that were arresting black and Asian kids for defending themselves against racist attacks. Mm. You know, there wasn't any justice for us. And that hostility that was never covered in the press, it was always just kind of ignored. That's what we grew up with. So it was very plain for us to see, you know, or plain for me to see, and then and plain for me to respond to. But then, you know, I've got my son now who, you know, he's got an awareness of it, particularly over the last 12 months with what's happened with COVID and George Floyd, but, you know, has got this awareness of race at a young age, not the blatant experiences that I had endured by the time I was 10, but, you know, he's got that awareness of it. But at the same time, unlike myself, you know, he supports the England football team, you know, and, you know, he you know, was bawling when England got knocked out of the World Cup in 2018. I've never cried for England losing a sport before. That just wasn't, that's just foreign to me. But the same thing is that as three generations of black males, we've evolved in terms of our relationship with this country in a way that the country's relationship with us has not evolved. And that was the big thing for me, is that my son will be facing these hidden barriers that are going to be really difficult for him to negotiate, because unlike my ones, you know, I could see it was plain in my face. If the police stopped and searched me, as painful and as embarrassing as that was, I kind of knew what not to do next time round. Mm. You know, I always have this incident where I went into a shop with a white friend of mine, and I was, I don't know, probably about 9 or 10. And as we came out the shop, I got stopped and searched. And only me. So my friend, he wasn't stopped and searched, just me and the police. You know, it's daytime, coming back from school. They thought I'd stolen something. I hadn't stolen anything. Embarrassed me in front of the street, didn't apologize, walked on. So from that moment on, I kind of knew, okay, Derek, don't ever go into a shop with an item that you've purchased in another shop, because that will just give them an excuse. Or if I'm going to go into a shop, then just make sure you buy something, even if it's small. Just buy something so people can't get you. And that's a horrible state to be in. Yeah. It's a horrible paranoid state to be in. But I kind of had a response to it. When I look at my son now and I'm like, what I worry about is, you know, algorithm racism, AI racism, or the kind of hidden covert stuff where, you know, any kid that's got any level of self-reflection, when stuff goes wrong, you start to think, is it me? Is it me? And if you don't have that, sometimes things that are blatant, and I'm not saying you go back to days of blatant, I'm just saying that the challenge is different, but ultimately the racism is still there. It just has taken another form.
I just want to go back to something that you said, because you reminded me of something, and I do want to come back to talk about you and your son. I sometimes wonder whether, like, you know, in the swathes of immigration, whether that was you know, from Jamaica in the 50s or 40s and 50s, or with the with Indians in the 50s and 60s, I always wonder whether the British envisaged us staying long enough to put down roots and have families. And I'm reminded of one of the most beautiful and tragic things I've ever seen on British television, just mostly because it reminds me of my mum, is an episode of Desmond's where Desmond has had an operation. I reference this in Brown Baby in the book, but Desmond has had an operation, and there's a conversation between Shirley and Pork Pie. And Shirley is saying, neither of us ever imagined we'd die here. We both came over imagining we'd make our money and we'd go back to Guyana and we'd die there. And I think that Desmond still wants that. He still wants to go back to Guyana and to die there. But I'm not ready to. You know, we've had a family here. We've put down roots. We've got the shop and all the rest of it. Because with my dad never talked about the stuff that he went through ever. He was stoic. He was just one of those, let's just get on with it kind of guys. And I don't want you to know what I've been through, because I don't want you to feel like it's going to be as hard for you as it was for me, because that's not the dream. And so it was almost as if it was as much for him as it was for me. But I think about that episode of Desmond's all the time, because I think that is quintessentially the kind of the contradictory tragedy of the immigrant experience.
It's so true, because I remember not going back to, but my mum and dad going back to Jamaica for the first time in the early 90s, 91. And it was like 30 years that they'd been in this country. So they'd been in this country longer than they had been in Jamaica, because they came over, you know, in their early 20s. And they had a great time. And it was unbelievable them seeing their relatives again and stuff. But there wasn't that desire to go back again. You know, so it was really weird, because, you know, we went back, or I went back to Jamaica, and even though I knew that I didn't quite fit in, you know, I used to, you know, walk around trying to be Jafaican, you know, and wearing all types of things that made me look like, that I thought made me look like one of the sort of ragga DJs of the early 90s, and sort of quickly walked into, you know, Montego Bay airport, and, you know, had these guys just shouting out Hinglish, Hinglish, you know, and it was like, oh, don't I blend in, and, you know, and, you know, which was like super embarrassing. But at the same time, being there was incredibly warm. I didn't feel like, oh, I'm gonna relocate to Jamaica and this is my homeland, but it felt like a home, and it felt important for my mum and dad, I feel, to go back and to feel that and to see it again, perhaps if only to have some confirmation that they were not going to quite go back. And I don't know, I haven't had that conversation with them, whether that is a tragedy for them or it's a bind, or whether they've, like, you know, this is, you know, England is our home and things of that nature. But, you know, there's almost something romantic in the way that they talk about back home that feels like it would almost be sullied if they were to go back, having been in this country for, you know, whatever, 50, 60 years, you know.
And going back to what you were saying about your son and your daughter, and obviously your son's kind of increased awareness of the way the world is in the last 12 months. You started talking about it, but I just wanted to expand on it because I think it's really interesting. How do we raise our kids to be aware of the realities of the world and the space that they take up in the world and how that will be viewed by others, but also ensure that they are as joyful and as boundless and as filled with ambition and all the rest of it as anyone else? You know, that's always my big worry, because I worry that I will then end up just projecting all of my bullshit onto them, all of
yeah. I mean, it's the eternal battle that we have, right? You know, so probably a bit like your father, my dad was also reluctant to share. I am of a generation where I probably overshare. So, you know, in the one sense, I was probably, particularly with my daughter, like just super black, you know. So it was like from the time that, you know, my daughter was walking, it was like, you know, everything from the books that she was reading, that I was reading to her, to the dolls, to everything. It was like, I think I even got a Malcolm X comic book, right? I searched online and got a Malcolm X sort of comic book of his life and was reading that. So for me, it was like, I had this huge anxiety of, God, I need to instill this in them, you know, straight away. And I'm going to overshare, you know, and I'm going to overshare about my experiences and all of that sort of stuff. And I've kind of chilled. I think, you know, you have a second kid and you slightly end up being a bit more laid back about these things. And you start to realize that actually, you know, if you look at my bookshelf, if you look at the pictures that's on my wall, if you look at, you know, obviously my family, the food we eat and everything, actually they are surrounded by my culture and black, British, black Caribbean culture. It's there. And while there are moments where you have to have that conversation, you know, you have to have that conversation to enable your kids to negotiate this world, you also start to realize that in the same way that kids pick up on parts of your behavior that you absolutely don't think that they would, actually the images that they see, the way the conversations that they hear me having on a day-to-day basis, from this to, you know, them attending talks that I do, to the literature that myself and my partner write, you know, they recognize certain things just through our being. But I will never ever tell you that I've got that balance licked, because there's been times when, you know, I've really wanted to put stuff on them at a really young age and had to be checked in terms of, Derek, don't impose the anxieties that you had and the lifelong anxieties that you had on them. They need to experience it themselves. And it's that parent's instinct that you want to experience every piece of hurt on their behalf. You don't want them to experience any of that stuff, but at the same time they have to go through it. But, you know, always, you know, the other thing that always strikes me is that, you know, I remember my dad saying to me at one point that, you know, my dad was a painter and decorator and you know, before he retired, and he turned around and he was doing some work in Ladbroke Grove, and I was living in Ladbroke Grove at the time, so I'd go at lunchtime to you know, hang out with him in between working, and I never forget him turning around and saying to me, you know, God, I'm glad I'm not growing up in these times. And this was probably around 2004, 2005. And I was like, you crazy. You know, you grew up in the 60s. You had it much harder than I did. And he was just like, well, yeah, in some respects it was, but, you know, we could make our way. We had some freedom to be able to do our own thing and to be able to, you know, if we wanted to create our businesses, there was just none of this. There was just no barriers in terms of that. And you know, again, I don't want to impose stuff on my son, because I want him to be, you know, I loved what you said about being joyful. And the thing that I got from my parents amid all of the stuff growing up in Newham was joy. Joy in the food we ate, joy in the making of the food that we had, music, lots of laughter, you know, endlessly me and my sisters and my family taking the mickey out of each other, you know. We, you know, debate as well. There's, you know, I always used to worry a lot because, you know, when I got a bit older and me and my dad used to have some scraps on, you know, about politics and stuff. And I was like, this is healthy. This is good. Because, you know, some of my friends, they wouldn't even talk to their dads. They, you know, they'd be in the room with them and it's like, there's no conversation. It's like me and my dad are going at it politically. So that thing of, you know, ultimately my mum and dad incubated me a lot from stuff that was going on the outside. And part of that thing was, even if outside isn't quite so safe, in here is safe, in here is joyful, and in here, irrespective of how much money we have or we don't have, we're going to eat well, we're going to laugh, we're going to sit down and watch movies together, and we're going to just hang out. And that's always, that's remained the same. It's remained the same. I think I might have said this to you before. The most precious item I've got is, like, you know, my mum did me a cookbook a few years ago of her recipes. And that, you know, to this day, you know, my mum's cooking is the thing that binds my family and my friends, and everything. So for me, that gift that she gave me, her home recipes with her stories and her anecdotes of how she came about to cook these foods, with not much in the way of proper sort of measurements. It's like a cup full of this and a, you know, a couple of teaspoons of that, you know, but that joy is the one thing that I am desperately holding on to in terms of how I raise my kids, to make sure that, you know, I'm not this morose, aloof, grumpy type of dude, you know.
And as you were talking, I was just reflecting on the fact that it's so rare to have these conversations. I get, you know, in the public eye, you know, on a podcast between two men of color being vulnerable about, you know, raising children and all the rest of it, but also, you know, all of this stuff that is particular to the experience of raising non-white kids in this country. Like, obviously, you know, there is, you know, I'm not putting us in the same boat, you know, there is such specificity between, you know, your background and heritage and mine, but the fact that, you know, in 2020 these conversations, 2021 these conversations are starting to happen, or starting to happen publicly rather than, you know, just on text or what have you. It's just like, I need more of this. I need more of these conversations, Derek. You know, this is just filled me with such hope for the world and like such warmth and loveliness. Thank you so much.
No, and thank you, because, you know, one of the things that I reflected upon when I was writing the book was being a kid and being stopped and searched by the police and having these incidents with teachers at school. We didn't talk about any of that stuff. So I thought I was just going through it alone. And I thought that my experiences were worse than anyone else's. And they weren't. You know, there were people that were going, the stuff that I might have been dealing with, you know, every week, people were dealing with every day. You know, the stuff that I thought I was really embarrassed about, people were going through the same thing. But because we, as well, men generally, but we were just not talking about it. So it's just really valuable that we do get to speak about these things, be open, be vulnerable, but also have a bit of a laugh about it too.
Derek A. Bardwell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Derek for joining us on the podcast today, and to you for your ears and your time. I hope it was a great listen for you. Please remember to subscribe and to leave us a review and a 5-star rating. Talk about us on social media. Please use the hashtag brownbabybook or hashtag brownbabypodcast. And you can like and subscribe and leave us a review and a 5-star rating, as I said. I mean, if you want to give us a 1 or 2-star rating, then maybe just keep that to yourself. The internet is filled with things that have undeserved 1 or 2-star ratings. Leave this one be. It's brand new. Thanks to my publisher, Bluebird, for the support, and to Acast. And please remember to buy the memoir, Brown Baby. It's out now. I will see you next week. Goodbye, my friends. Goodbye.
Brown baby, I am brown baby. Yes, I am. Silly brown baby.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.